Hello and welcome to The Final Draft, where we talk books and writing for 2SER. I'm Neda Vanovac and I'll be hosting for the next 2 months while Genevieve McGregor is away on a bit of a sabbatical. I'm looking forward to sharing some great new interviews with you over the coming weeks. And to kick things off, tonight we're going to go on two different journeys across Asia with two restless women who were both bitten by the travel bug. We've got an interview with Kim Barker, an American Central Asia correspondent for the Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau who lived a high-pressure life chasing suicide bombings and rigged elections. Steph Leong brings us the story of Australian writer Carolyn Shine, who thought moving continents would be easier than moving suburbs and went from Bondi to Vietnam. And later in the show, we'll take another peek into the world of the rereaders, who are this week talking about the exclusion of Indigenous poets in Australian anthologies. Stay with us.
Johnny Clegg, South Africa's music legend, returns. Johnny's pulsating rhythmic dances and harmonies will lift your soul. Book now at Ticketek for Johnny Clegg and his band at the Enmore Theatre on March 15. Proudly presented by Leonard Promotions and 2SER.
Welcome back, and you're listening to The Final Draft. American journalist Kim Barker turned up in Kabul not long after 9/11 without much of an idea of what she was doing. She was pretty quickly swept up in the whirlwind that is the life of a foreign correspondent, doing what they call the Taliban shuffle between Afghanistan and Pakistan for 8 years for the Chicago Tribune. Her book chronicles the surreal existence of journalists in war zones, always on the edge and about to crack, careening along on an adrenaline high. Along the way, she gives us background on the region and a peek into a life that saw her close friends kidnapped, her relationships broken down, and all the while, relentlessly hit on by senior Pakistani government officials looking for a lady. I spoke to Kim in New York about the importance of telling the story you see, being a woman in a war zone, and bluffing her way through some very bizarre situations. Do any sane and well-adjusted people go into working as foreign correspondents, or is everybody just running away from something?
It depends on how you define sane and well-adjusted. You know what I mean? Because I don't think I was insane, and I was relatively well-adjusted when I went over there. I just really liked doing the work.
What's the attraction of the work?
First time I went to Afghanistan, it just felt like such a foreign place. It felt like such this amazingly different culture than I was used to. Yet at the same time, people there were so friendly and so open and so hospitable and really just invited you into their lives. And I just very much got caught up in the narrative. I mean, some people say there's nothing like your first war. And I'm kind of joking there, but it's kind of true. It's just like I absorbed everything. I mean, it just consumed you. It consumed me, most definitely.
Yeah, this is not a 9-to-5 job.
No, there's no such thing as 9-to-5 with it. You live it. You become your work.
I found your descriptions of the world of foreigners in Afghanistan really interesting, and you described it as an aquarium, and you called yourself a frog in boiling water. What did you mean by that?
Oh, frogs, when they get into boiling water, don't know that they're boiling. So, I mean, and we were in some respects very much that way, especially in Afghanistan. Like, you know, you just had no idea that going to this particular suicide bomb right after it happened could be dangerous, and then being out in this particular area could be dangerous, that walking home at this particular time of night could be dangerous. You just sort of got used to the fact of living in this environment.
You said in the book that you felt that you were constantly failing your Afghan friends and acquaintances and not reciprocating in friendships the way they might have wanted. And is this just a cultural gap?
As far as me not being able to, like, reciprocate enough, I mean, you're talking about a lot of reciprocation.
Yeah.
The sort of thing, like, you know, when you're going to be a good Afghan friend, you've got to stay for dinner. Very poor form to have the excuse at the very last minute that, oh, I'm sorry, I've got a deadline story. I'm sorry there was a suicide bomb. Can't come to dinner. And you would feel like, well, that's not an excuse. You know, you work too much. That was always the thing that I would get. You work too much. You know, you don't have time to spend time enough. And it's true.
Did you ever find your equilibrium between that kind of push and pull of one culture and another in your job and your friends?
You're always juggling. I think that, I mean, my job always went out over everything. So you're never really going to find that equilibrium. I did learn the longer I was there that, hey, you're not doing a sprint here, you're doing a marathon. So unless you start trying to balance a little bit, you just burn out. And I also really tried to show in the book how much I burned out, because I was seriously burned out by the time I left. I mean, anybody who decides that it's a better idea to quit their perfectly good job in the worst recession of journalism in American history and instead spend their time unemployed in Afghanistan is seriously burned out.
How would you categorize the relationship between a reporter and their fixer? Like, could you do what you do there without one?
No. I mean, you're absolutely dependent. They are your paid best friend, and you are stupid without them. Without him, I was pretty much nothing. I mean, what could I have done in a country? Well, I could have talked to people who spoke English. Yeah, I could have done that. You know, I could have somehow managed by making friends with somebody who spoke both languages, or maybe learning both languages, which would have taken years and years and years. Without him, I couldn't have done nearly the kind of stories that I was able to do there, and I also wouldn't have had somebody who was looking after my back so much.
How much of going over there did you feel that you were just totally thrown in the deep end with no idea of what you were doing?
Pretty much all of it. I had no idea what I was doing. But I guess you can look back to the first time you do any sort of story. You have no idea what you're doing. And a lot of it is like, all right, sink or swim.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm going to bluff my way through.
Yeah, I'm going to bluff my way through it. I can do this. You know, and by the end of it, I'll figure it out. The one thing that I just kept holding on to is, you know how to tell a story. You know how to tell a story. And you'll eventually figure this out.
Yeah. You did several embeds with the military when you were over there, and you talk about wanting to get your war on. How did your expectations of what that might be live up to what you actually got?
Yeah, it's so ridiculous because you're going into a situation like that. And again, I didn't know what to expect. I was just sort of like, you know, watching Band of Brothers, expecting all this, you know, macho stuff. Also expecting, you know, as somebody who grew up with relatively liberal parents who were hippies, you know, I sort of expected, I couldn't relate to soldiers. I figured that's what it would be like. But instead, you know, I found a lot of war, and a lot of this particular war was sitting around and waiting and being quite bored a lot of the time. And I really did end up connecting with a lot of these soldiers and feeling bad for them, especially being in such a foreign environment, often just, you know, totally isolated from the local people, seeing everybody as your enemy.
You did say that when you were on the embeds, you were talking about how the troops were so starved for female company that they revealed things to you that they probably shouldn't have. And how aware do you think they were of your status as a journalist? And did you feel that you were taking advantage of that at all?
No, you know, they were very aware that I was a journalist, like maybe an older sister or something like that, somebody who's willing to listen to their stories. You know, you always have your notebook out. You're always taking notes. I think that perhaps they didn't understand I would be so interested in the things I was interested in. I do think that to a large extent, male and female journalists are going to see embeds in different ways. I mean, some embeds you go on and all you're looking for is the bang bang and you just want to write about conflict and things like that. At least for me, I was never that interested in that, maybe because I'm more of a chicken. But I did really enjoy telling stories about what it was like being in the military, what it was like, you know, feeling like you were doing something that was so forgotten by the rest of the world, the sort of toll all these constant deployments takes on your personal life, on your relationships, on marriages. And, you know, I did make decisions that I knew at certain points, like, this person is going to hate this story. This person is going to wish they never talked to me.
And what happened with the fallout when that did happen and you did publish those stories and they got into a lot of trouble?
Oh, yeah. That first particular story I did, I had this guy that, he was the nicest guy. I really liked him. And Ben Crowley, and he talked to me very frankly about how this war was so boring. Every time he went out of the wire, he would not be locked and loaded, which is totally against policy. So I would repeatedly ask him, are you locked and loaded now? Are you locked and loaded now? I even asked him in front of, you know, a superior officer, are you locked and loaded? And he's just like, nah. Nobody ever said don't use that. My feeling at a certain point is you got to tell the story right in front of you, even if you know it's going to upset people.
But did you ever feel that kind of personal pull between really liking a guy like Crowley and then writing a story that wasn't going to necessarily reflect so well on him?
I mean, I did the story. I did the story right in front of me every single time. Mm-hmm. And while knowing that, like, okay, they might not like it, but eventually they might understand it. I mean, because I'd been in that position a number of times before, and you felt at a certain extent you would write things and you'd be like, they're not going to like that particular paragraph. They probably won't like that particular characterization. They won't like that I use that particular quote. But that's not my job. It's not my job to do some sort of story that the protagonist is necessarily happy with. My job is to do a story that reflects the reality that I'm seeing out there.
What about fear? Did you ever think that it was a crazy thing to be running towards explosions when everybody else is running away? Where, like, people you know were being kidnapped and killed. Were you ever just struck by the ridiculousness and the horror of the stuff you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. My job was ridiculous.
You were at the scene of the bombing that killed Benazir Bhutto as well. Did you ever reach a point where you just became immune to the kinds of things that you were seeing and writing about?
No, I was never immune because my feeling, you know, I've covered the cops beat. I've seen some relatively bad stuff before. You know, I also covered tsunami and I've covered earthquakes. You see bad things. And my philosophy has always been that any time that I feel like I'm not conveying the things that I'm seeing or the grief of people who are involved, if I'm not able to convey that in a story to the average public, then I got to stop doing this job. So in a way, I really tried to feel everything I was writing about, which took a lot more effort as the years went on to be true. And at a certain point, you know, I think very much towards the end of the book, I kind of felt like I'm done with this. I think I've seen my last suicide bombing. I don't think it's healthy necessarily for me to do this anymore. Some people can handle it. I mean, I don't think ultimately I'm one of them.
Yeah. You said that your home leave was 1 week every 2 years. What kind of support were you getting from your paper beyond financial support? I mean, it seems like they drop you into this very surreal situation. And you said that when you returned to Chicago, you were so far gone, it felt like walking into a different time zone. How do they support you through something like that?
They do just throw you out there. Part of the job is being able to parachute into a very foreign place and do it. And just do it, you know what I mean? And not necessarily ask for hand-holding or ask how it's done or call back and say, I need a hug or anything like that. Nobody ever told me you've got to handle your own business, but I kind of felt like I did, especially if I wanted to be named a permanent correspondent. And I just learned what I was doing, and you learn a lot from other correspondents. You learn a lot from locals on the ground. I mean, I had very supportive editors who were always there if I needed to talk about anything. I just never talked to them about anything. And it was interesting because I wrote this op-ed for the New York Times in February about why we need female foreign correspondents after the Laura Logan incident, and referred to one of the groping incidents I had in Pakistan. And one of my former editors write me and say that he was just horrified that happened. How come I hadn't talked to him about it? That he hoped that I knew that they would support me no matter what happened. And yeah, I'm sure they would have.
Did you just feel like it was something they couldn't really understand?
Right. They couldn't understand it. And what are they going to do? What is the solution to that? Do you need to come home? Do you need some counseling? Do you need a hug? No, I want to stay. I want to stay with the story. So therefore, I'm not going to say anything.
Well, I mean, you're out there swinging punches at the guys pinching you, so it seemed like you were doing okay defending yourself.
Yeah, I was handling it. I'm not going to say I was handling it gracefully.
But you were handling it.
Yeah.
Would you ever be a foreign correspondent again?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I keep, like, I'm so torn on it. It's something that I always miss. I mean, I'm always going to feel that pull.
That was journalist Kim Barker, author of The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
VoiceWorks magazine's spring issue is here, and it's full of the season's best new writing. Issue 86 is themed V and includes fiction, non-fiction, poetry and visual art by contributors under 25. Available now online and in all good bookstores, VoiceWorks is published by Express Media. For more information, check out expressmedia.org.au. Express Media is here for young writers. Express Media is a sponsor of 2SER.
You're listening to The Final Draft. Now, to hop from Central to Southeast Asia. After returning from a stint living in Hanoi for 18 months, Carolyn Shine wrote a memoir of her travels, Single White Female in Hanoi.
Taking off on a whim, she ended up working various jobs such as teaching English, sub-editing a propaganda news sheet, and forming a blues band. But while preparing to launch the book in July this year, Carolyn was diagnosed with cancer of the appendix and underwent chemotherapy. 2SER's Steph Leong spoke to Carolyn after her treatment to find out about her rescheduled book launch in November and to see what exactly prompts a single white female to pack up and move to Hanoi.
At the very beginning of the book, you mentioned that you went over to Hanoi with no real plans for a job or really a place to live, but there was so much enthusiasm that came across the page. Can you tell me what initiated a single white female to pack up and move to Hanoi?
Right. Well, I had this fantastic life in Bondi. I was working as a musician and teaching piano, and it was just a great life. And when things get really good, I start to want to change. It's just probably one of those tortured Westerner things. And so I started thinking about moving suburbs, but that meant losing all my piano students. So I thought, well, if I'm going to move suburbs, I may as well just move continents. So I thought I might go and live in Asia for a while. And the thing about Asia was that I'd spent time in Bali and Turkey and fallen in love with both of those places, unsurprisingly, because they're so charming and the people are so hospitable and lovely.
Oh, they are. I've been to Bali myself and, lovely.
Incredible
people,
culture.
Yeah.
But I very naively, actually idiotically, thought that what lay in between Turkey and Bali, i.e. Asia, would consist of something kind of a hybrid of the two. Yeah, and so I'd be totally charmed.
It's all the same, really.
Well, it's so not.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
Ridiculous, not only ridiculously naive, but criminally naive, really, because this is a lot of what the book's about, which is a thing called cultural relativism, which, as far as I can make out, is the idea that all cultures are equal and charming, with the possible exception of our own horrible Western culture, which we should apologise for when travelling. And so I sort of went over with that baggage that I didn't realise I was carrying.
Yeah. Now, I understand that there is this great difference between North and South Vietnam.
Yeah.
You really made a conscious effort to stay mainly in the North and
more
in
intense.
Hanoi. Yeah, what was the attraction in doing that?
I think I like intensity. I think I like putting myself through extreme experiences, because the thing is that Saigon in the south, now known as Ho Chi Minh City, is quite westernised compared to Hanoi. Hanoi really was behind some kind of bamboo curtain, and it was like sealed off, and the people were like aliens. I couldn't read their body language. I couldn't read anything. I was in another planet, on another planet where all the signifiers had been knocked into some other shape, and I was unable to communicate.
Else.
It was like being autistic. I couldn't read anything. There was no theory of mind. I couldn't understand what anyone was thinking, ever.
Now, I really loved reading the parts where you attempt to speak Vietnamese and a bit of French, because there's quite a few French speakers in Hanoi, and it kind of reminded me when I was in Switzerland, in a German-speaking town in Switzerland last year, and I really have no clue about the German language at all. Horrible pronunciation altogether. And I kind of at times would mix it up and draw on English phrases, put in a bit of English every now and then, and also draw on my own high school knowledge of French as well, which is quite bad. And if there was nothing in my little guidebook, to get me through, you know, a bit of sign language goes a long way too. Now, I feel that you're a great example of someone who threw away that Lonely Planet guide and learned about Hanoi in that sense. What are some of the life lessons that you've taken away, whether that be about travelling or romance or cultural relativism, clash?
Okay. My cultural relativism was really knocked out of me in Hanoi, because I encountered a lot of things that just weren't charming. The Northern Vietnamese people aren't trying to be charming. They're not charming. They're pretty screwed up from a lot of conflict, and they're good communists. They're very nationalistic, and they're Confucianist. They look at their family and would possibly step over somebody else who was dying in the street. I don't know. That's a bit of a damning thing to say, and I'm not sure. But family come first. And they just weren't charming. And it took me a really long time to come to terms with the fact that a culture shouldn't have to be charming. You know, it's not there to charm me.
It's not there to please other people.
That's right. It just turns on its own axis and has done for a very long time, and it's quite stable, and most of the people are relatively happy. They enjoy their life.
Now, speaking of family, I'm going to ask about romance, because you recently wrote an article. That's my segue there. Now, you recently wrote an article for CNN, and just where the byline is, it had Carolyn Shine got so fed up with being rejected by Vietnamese men, and she wrote a book. A bit of
that
a harsh,
she wrote a book about it.
That she wrote a book
excruciating.
About it.
Excruciating.
A bit of a harsh accusation there. Now, whether that be true...
Smarts a bit.
No,
it wasn't true.
Well,
just for the record, for vanity's sake, I didn't really get rejected because I didn't really... I worked out
on
that,
the record.
I mean, guys just weren't chasing me. That was the problem, and I was expecting it, and it wasn't. I was thinking, you know, well, in Bali, it's a smorgasbord for Western women, which... Terrible thing, really. I'm not a sex pat or anything. I've always been attracted to Southeast Asian guys, which is really unusual. So I just presumed that romance would be on the agenda, but it was a very interesting phenomenon that
those guys are
looking for a Vietnamese wife. I mean, they find Western women tall, hairy, scary, independent, freckly. I don't know. They just don't think we're very attractive by and large, especially in the North. The South, apparently, from the hundreds and hundreds of bits of fan mail I'm now getting, feel differently about it, and a lot of Vietnamese guys are writing to me telling me I should try in the South now to find a boyfriend, as though 10 years later I'm still desperately trying to find a Vietnamese boyfriend.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, I mean, whether the accusations were right or wrong, but for the record.
Yeah, untrue. I'd like to write that wrong.
Untrue. How are you dealing with these advances, these men beckoning at your doorsteps?
It's really funny. It's cute too. Some of them are really sweet. I've actually made contact. A couple of people have broken through my guard there, and a couple of Vietnamese journalists, and I'm going to do interviews for them. For Vietnamese Press, a women's paper. And she was smart. She wanted to redress that idea because she could tell that my book, maybe she's read it, I don't know. She says there's a big vibe on my book in Vietnam. I've had a couple of offers now from publishers there. But she said that she felt that it needed to be redressed, that it wasn't about, you know, desperate single white chick, you know,
gagging for it
in Vietnam, can't get laid. And, you know, and there's another journalist at UTS who I said I'd do a piece for, and he writes for an Vietnamese language Australian rag. So they made it through. They just won me over. Their emails.
Now, Carolyn, you have come in during our subscriber drive, which started earlier this week and runs until next week as well. I understand you've helped out in community radio before. What do you love most about community radio?
You didn't prepare me for that. That's cruel. Community radio makes my heart swell. All community things do. I'm a community kind of person, and I think when people get together and do things for communities, that's just what it's all about. Actually, nothing makes me happier than community activity.
I'm not a communist. Now, there is a book launch for your novel happening in November, I believe.
November the 10th at Ariel Booksellers in Paddington, opposite what used to be the cinema there. I think that's gone now. It's at 6:30 for 7, and we're going to have some lovely vegetarian Vietnamese catering from Miss Chu in Darlinghurst, and there'll be some nice wine, and there will be... this is sounding irresistible. And there'll be some great music too, live music, because I can't do anything without having live music. That's just where I come from.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us on our subscriber drive week at 2SER. Now, pen that into your diary, guys, definitely. So that's 10th of November at Ariel Bookstore in Paddington for the book launch, for Carolyn Shine's book launch, Single White Female in Hanoi.
That was author of Single White Female in Hanoi, Carolyn Shine, speaking to 2SER's Stephanie Leong. This week, we're also taking another peek into the world of the rereaders, extracted from their fortnightly podcast. Writers Sam Twyford-Moore, Rebecca Giggs and Fiona Wright discuss a lecture delivered at the recent Australian Poetry Symposium held in Newcastle. Poet Peter Minter took a stand against a new and controversial anthology of post-invasion poetry.
This week we're talking about Peter Minter's lecture about the exclusion of modern Aboriginal poets from the recently published Australian Poetry Since 1788, a 1,100-page anthology edited by Geoffrey Lehman and Robert Gray. Fiona, is all anthologising of poetry on this scale inherently political and ideological, or did Lehman and Gray get this especially and spectacularly wrong?
Ooh, it's a big question. I think all anthologising is a work of choosing your canon. So it always involves deciding what is and isn't Australian literature in a way. But I do think that when you're calling a book Australian Poetry Since 1788, it's laying your cards straight on the line. And as Peter points out in his lecture, that within that grand scale, within that 1,100 pages of anthology, there are two Indigenous poets included. It's a very strange book. It's very big. There have been some very weird decisions made about who's in and who's not. The current gossip on the poetry circle, as people have been referring to it, as the Grey Lemon anthology, which I quite like, just because of the perceived misguidedness of it, I suppose.
Mm. It's a controversial book, and I guess you're right in saying that since 1788 suggests that there was no poetry before that time, or that, you know, and as Peter mentions in the lecture, that there was no culture, essentially, that the colonialism and bringing the European Enlightenment was the start of Australian culture.
Well, was the start of Australia, and regardless of that, if they're just using it as a start point for this idea of Australia, it still sets it up as a colonial project in many ways.
It was a bit of a vanity project as well, wasn't it? I mean, perhaps I'm using that term too liberally, but Peter points out that it was initially bankrolled by Lehman, and that it's New South Books, isn't it? UNSW.
Yep.
Yeah, it may not have touched the project if it weren't for...
Well, speaking as a publisher, anthologies are incredibly difficult to put together. They're very time-consuming, and you have to... There's a lot of expense in putting them together because all of those poems that are already published need to be paid for. You need to pay for the permissions. So there's a lot of output before you even get the book together. So that, you know, most publishers are kind of wary. Anthologies are a strange thing because they are expensive to produce, but they tend to sell better than regular poetry books because there's this idea that you're getting value for money and that you're getting a good, you know, it's a book that people won't downright hate because there's so many different things in there, and it's sort of educational as well. So if you can counter the educational market, then you're doing really, really well.
But regardless of like who is the internal politics of the book, say, it's inherently political anyway because it's you know, it's branch stacking almost. It's choosing who's in and who's out. So Peter makes the point it excludes modernists or postmodernist poets, exactly, you know, tending towards the lyric poem instead, and also excludes migrant voices.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've been very upset about. At Giramondo, although Ivor Indyk has said on many occasions, I'm very proud to have published many poets who are not in that anthology.
Right. And so we actually have Lehman and Gray in the introduction saying, we have been wary of humanist homily, of uplift, and of the politically right-minded. And it's ironic that the review in The Australian of the book, glowingly positive by Peter Price, was in fact titled Poetic Justice, whereas what Peter is suggesting is that this is a complete injustice, that it's in fact a cultural erasure. How can you put together a book of 1,100 pages and have two Indigenous poets?
And that's one of the things I really liked about this lecture that Peter Minter gave, that he prefaced it by saying that there are some times where you have to get up and make a stand. And I think that's a wonderful thing to see in the poetry scene. It's sort of gearing towards a good old-fashioned poetry fight that we haven't seen the likes of.
One, two, three, four, I declare a poet's war.
That's right. But to see people speaking that passionately about their craft and about how important these things are politically is wonderful and very refreshing.
The book is huge, isn't it? It's 2 kilos. It's even when he picks it up and kind of waves it at the audience in a way that's kind of provocative because it's a
goes to lob it into the audience.
Into the audience, yeah, yeah. It is canonical in that, you know, physically it looks like it's a presence object, you know.
And my favourite part of the lecture is actually when he stops talking about the poems but actually talks about the M papers and the design of the M papers.
That's
and that
very
these
good part,
M papers
yeah.
are actually appropriated from Aboriginal iconography. And there's a fantastic line in it where he says that this imitates Aboriginal iconography in order to supply some kind of echo of cultural rootedness for an anxious British colonial culture. Mm-hmm. It's just a fantastic lecture, and we'll put a link up on our website.
It's totally changed my opinion of the book, I think.
Yeah. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Fiona.
Thanks, Sam.
You've been listening to The Rereaders for Final Draft. You can find us at www.thereReaders.com.
That was writers Sam Twyford-Moore, Rebecca Giggs and Fiona Wright talking about the politics of anthologies and the exclusion of Indigenous voices. And that's all we have time for tonight. My name is Ned Ivanovac and you've been listening to The Final Draft. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.